Sharon B.
Hi, I'm Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic. And it's nice to be here. It's been a beautiful day. It's real special to be back up here and to re-meet Lisa. And thank you, Lisa, and thank you, Mike, for asking me up here to be with you today. It was about 4 years ago. Your speaker tonight is Tommy W. from down south Laguna Way. And it was about 4 years ago the two of us spoke at a day of sobriety somewhere near here. And I was reflecting on the changes in our life in 4 years. And I think I was the afternoon speaker and he was the evening speaker, and we were both staying at the Los Gatos Inn or something. We met the next morning before our flights went out for breakfast. And at that time, I was going through a hideous divorce, and I was depressed a lot of the time. And I never thought my life would change or my feelings about life would change because I was kind of trudging at the moment. And his wife had died of cancer just that year. And we sat and commiserated over breakfast. I remember, I don't even think that either one of us tasted the food, but we talked about our lives and how they were and how we weren't going to give up hope. And 4 years later, he just walked in, but he's here with his lovely bride, Gloria, and his life has changed immensely, immensely. There's light on in his eyes, and he's enjoying life again, and it brings me hope. And I'm here with the man of my dreams, and I never thought that would happen. And my life has changed immensely in 4 years of walking through tough stuff and staying sober no matter what. And it's just kind of special that we're both doing this again. I don't know if he remembers that breakfast, but maybe I talked and he listened. I don't know. He talked and I cried, but it was, you know, it was just one of those moments. And reflecting upon it, I can see the growth in my life and the people around me. And as I'm going through things in sobriety, I don't always know I'm growing, you know. I don't always know that, oh, this is painful, so it must mean I'm growing. You know, I don't sit in the middle of my pain and think about that. I have been taught how to suit up and show up and be of service and keep your commitments no matter what. And don't put the phone don't unplug the phone and don't hide in bed. And if it was up to me, those are the things I'd do. I'd run. I would run because I still don't like pain. It's a necessary part of life, I have a feeling. Maybe when I grow up, I'll accept it a little more. But I was also moved by Thelma, who couldn't say alcoholic, kind of stuck in her throat as she was introducing herself to us today. And I identify with that. I couldn't say that word for a long time because my jaw was wired shut. The first 3 months I was here, it was broken for me, so I couldn't talk, Thelma. So I had 3 months to think about it. So... And another word that used to stick in my throat all the time was the word grateful. I mean, I could not say I am grateful, and it just would stick in my throat. I think I was 7 years sober before I was able to say that word. And today I'm a grateful alcoholic. Isn't that schmaltzy? But it's true. I got up, and we came on a plane this morning, and Julie, I guess you call her L.A. Julie, picked us up, and I got to watch Julie get sober, and I got to watch Julie change, and I got to watch her walk through tough stuff with dignity. And she picked us up, and she's just been the perfect hostess. I mean, she ordered up a beautiful day. Even the fog, we took the ferry over to Sausalito, and even the fog hung on the bridge like it does in the postcards, you know. I couldn't have asked for a more beautiful day, and I've just been having a lot of fun being up here, and being with you is why I'm here, because I try to be of service in life today. I try to see what I can bring to a situation instead of what I can take from it, how I can make the world a better place for my being on the planet today than a not-so-better place by me existing. Let's just say that Marin is all, the county of Marin is a better place today because we're all sitting in here sober. It's a much better place today. I mean, we are part of the force for good, Alcoholics Anonymous is, and so I'm real grateful to be here and see my friend Chuck, too, who I watched come in and watch change and watch his life get better for him and watch people take risks in life and go on. And it feels real special to be with you today. So thank you for having me. I was born in Iowa when I first realized that it was my first resentment. And as I grew up, I always felt like I was misplaced. I always felt like the ship dropped me off and I used to search the skies at night for the mothership. And I wondered why I was there. I never fit in with my family. I never fit in the town I was in. I just didn't fit in. I didn't fit in my own skin. See, I knew nothing was an inside job until I surrendered, until alcohol surrendered me enough to come to you in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought it was out there somewhere for me to get. It was out there. And as I grew up, I, you know, things were fine. I'm one of four children. I am the dysfunctional adult of a normal functional family. I mean, I'm it. And they're all still fine. And I started to have some drinking problems about 13 years old. And, you know, when I drank, I blacked out. When I blacked out, I did crazy things. And it's just the pattern I always had. And but I remember I had drank before then. I grew up with a Czechoslovakian heritage, and they had wedding dances, and they did the weddings and wedding dances, and the wedding went all day and all night. And I used to sip on my mother's drinks, and I remember I could dance a little bit easier. But, you know, it was never really a drunk until it was the summer of my 14th birthday. I was turning 14 that summer, and it was that summer. And I remember sitting on a 57 Chevy out in the country roads with all those football player type guys and all the girls that hit puberty always before me. And I was sitting there, and I was drinking Canadian Club and Schlitz beer. And I remember when it hit home, when it hit my gut, when it hit my toes, there was a feeling of relief that happened that I hadn't known about before. You know, as my sponsor said, it filled holes I didn't even know I had. And I became the life of the party. You know, the chest fairy visited me momentarily, too. I could stand up straight, cross my legs, looked like Marilyn Monroe's instead of being skinny, and I danced with them, I told jokes, I drove them all home. I didn't know I knew how to drive yet, and alcohol did something for me that I didn't forget, you know, and I got sick, and the next day was Sunday, and I remember feeling remorseful and guilty, and I had to go off to church with my parents with this awful hangover. And but I couldn't wait to do it again. I was already scheming on how to get that feeling again because it did something terrific for me that nothing had done before. And I thought alcohol did that for everybody for a long time. I didn't know that it only does it to a certain percentage of the people that drink it. You know, the reason I'm here is because I drank alcohol, and I drank it long enough so that it surrendered me to a non-existent person on this planet. It took away everything that I had, but I gave it freely. Now, that's the irony of this disease. I gave it freely. I gave my dignity. I gave my spirit. I gave my hopes and dreams. I gave parts of myself that I didn't even think I had, but I kept giving it out there, hoping that alcohol would fill those holes again, hoping that that Jose Cuervo gold tonight would just kickstart my Harley one more night, you know, and it didn't work anymore. Otherwise, I would still be out there doing it, you know. It surrendered me. That's what surrendered me. And I went to college. It was the late 60s, and if you were around in the late 60s, you know what it was like. I mean, there were a lot of drugs, and if you're like me, I didn't say no. I said more, you know, but I always drank, and I drank with my mescaline, and I drank with my LSD, and I took a lot. I would take handfuls because I was looking for truth, see, and I remember on 16 four-way hits of Orange Sunshine one night, I found truth, and it was in the Satanic Majesty's Request album by the Rolling Stones. And I looked for it later when I came down, and I couldn't find it. You know, it's like that's the way truth was with me. It was always over there. It was always elusive. It was always somebody else's. You know, I could never get a handle on truth. And it was very important for me, this search, to find truth, because I felt so ill at sorts being in this planet, being on this earth. And like I said, I didn't fit in my skin a lot. And I started to run. I had a big falling out with my family. I was involved in a lot of kind of artsy things and SDS and some other things. And my father got wind of it, and he tried to help me, and I had a suicide attempt, and I caused more attention to come upon me, and the family priest came to try to help me, and the priest and I got drunk, and they sent me to a psychiatrist. And when I go to psychiatrists, I fold my arms and I kick out my feet, and I have an attitude problem, and I don't say anything because I think we're paying you $75 an hour, buddy, you figure it out, you know? So there was no way anybody could help me, you know? But what I heard, see, I have a problem with my perception. I have selective hearing. What I hear people say to me is, you're not good enough. You're never going to make it. There's something missing in you. There's an enzyme missing in you. But what they were saying to me was, let us help you, or we don't know how to help you. But what I heard them say is, you're not enough. Because that's what I felt about myself, was that I wasn't enough. And I had this big falling out with my father, and it took years into Alcoholics Anonymous for that to get better. But it started then. And I moved to New York City. I worked in an advertising agency. I drank two-hour lunches with the other people because they drank. And we had a great time. And if you had a hangover, you just close your door and you wait until lunch. I mean, that's just the way it was. And then you could get better. But I was also eating lots of this acid all summer long and looking for truth. And I kind of flipped out. I couldn't go underground anymore and ride subways. I became very paranoid, and I put lots of locks on my apartment door so that I wouldn't get mugged. But I got mugged as I was trying to unlock all the locks on my door one night. And I just got real strange, and I begged my father to let me go back to school and give me another chance, and my dad did. He gave me another chance, and he paid for college for another semester, and it just didn't work. It didn't work. I had lost a lot of motivation. I had lost a lot of self-esteem by then. I just didn't think I could cut it. I really didn't think I could cut it. I heard potential all my life, that word, you know, but I thought if they looked real close, I didn't have those other two cylinders to fire up that they thought I had, you know, that I just didn't quite have that edge. And I knew that, and I knew they'd find out, so I kept moving. And I went to Colorado to be a cowboy. I thought that maybe that would fix it, and working in a restaurant one day, and walks the man of my dreams, which was at that time Bob Dylan, and if you were around in that time, and Bob Dylan was my hero, and you know, I didn't have Superman or anybody else, but Bob Dylan was my hero, and he walked into this restaurant and ordered a chocolate milkshake to go. My head said, "This is Bob Dylan," and I made two chocolate milkshakes to go, and I came to California with this man. Now, I don't know if it was Bob Dylan or not. I have no idea. I just know that he was very spiritual, and we had some nice experiences along the way, and in Laguna Beach, literally on the beach, he went his way, and I went mine. And I ended up at a commune in Huntington Beach where I'd lived for 4 months. I came with $2. I left with later, 4 months later, with $5 and a dog, and I made a profit, you know? So I thought that was working for me, and but the grass always looked greener to me. It always looked greener. I mean, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a speaker named Norm Alpe used to talk about the reason the grass looked greener is because the other guy took care of his lawn, you know. I could never quite get that, you know. I never quite got it, and I ended up 21 years old. I had turned 21 out dancing with the Krishnas in Westwood. It was very karmic because I had turned 21 that night. I had panhandled for my bottles of wine. I thought that was appropriate. And as soon as they found out it was my 20th, I was just hanging around because I liked the music, you know. And they found out it was my 21st birthday. They thought it was meant to be, you know. I was out there, and people always saw that hole in my psyche, you know. They always saw that brown aura or whatever I had, you know. And they always wanted to help me. You know, it was the Pentecostal Holy Rollers. It was the Jesus Freaks in Laguna. You know, it was the Krishnas in Westwood. They always wanted to help me. And I was willing. You know, I really was willing for some sort of change. But as soon as they said that word, forever, I said, I don't do forever. You know, if it doesn't fit in my knapsack, I don't want to own it. And I was out of there. And I ended up at home with Mom and Dad, 21 years old, sick. I was a full-blown alcoholic, and nobody knew it. They sent me to the family doctor because I was ill, and he gave me Valium for my nerves. And it was okay for me to live upstairs and stay out of my father's way as long as I didn't take any drugs, so I could drink as much alcohol as I wanted, because alcohol wasn't my problem. Alcoholism was not even a known disease to the people that in my family and that small town in Iowa. They didn't know alcoholism. They didn't recognize it, especially in a 21-year-old. You know, I was just having some problems. And by this time, my gallbladder was non-functional, I had pancreatitis, and I was very, very sick. And I was drinking alcohol every night, sitting in those taverns, those dark, dingy taverns, judging Billy Lang from high school. I knew he'd always be a loser. There he was sitting at the bar every night, you know. There I am sitting at the bar every night, judging him, you know, and I didn't get that. But I felt like my life had run out my sleeve. I felt like there was no more hope, I had no more dreams, and I didn't care anymore. And things were tense at home, and things were, you know, there was nothing left. I was 21, and there was nothing left, and nobody knew alcoholism. And this man walked into my life, and he was 6'8" tall, and he caught my attention, and he was wearing Eastern Indian gauze clothing, you know, the kind that kind of blows. He stood out in this small town in Iowa, that's for sure, and with the overalls. And he had these John Lennon glasses and these big eyes, and his hair would stand on end, and he had found something. I don't know what it was, but he said that he would take care of me, and I thought, great. You know, I can't do it anymore. And so he took me out of that town. He took me to an organic farm in northern Wisconsin. And at that organic farm, everybody and everything became organic, including me. He took away my cigarettes. He took away my alcohol. And he gave me organic pot to smoke. And that was okay with him. That's what I could smoke. And occasionally, he would pull out these little bottles of dandelion wine we had made, which was organic dandelion wine. It was a lot of work to make little bottles, I'll tell you that. And we would, you know, have this little dandelion wine, and I just couldn't get into it at all, you know. And I remember the night that I got really thirsty. It was the second snowfall of the winter,
And the first one, we had to sit there and look at each other for days. I mean, we didn't have TV or radio or, I mean, I don't know. You know, we just had this compost pile, organic bees, 50 head of organic sheep and organic horse. Phil was organic, you know. We had Mother Earth News we'd read. We'd read Yul Gibbons and, you know, and it was the second snowfall, and I thought, I can't do Mother Earth News for 2 days with this guy here. I mean, it was just, I was sitting in this rocking chair, and he was over in the corner with the record player with his Learn to Play the Banjo with Pete Seeger record on. And Phil had a 5-string banjo, and I don't know if he ever learned to play. I don't know. But they would teach him how to play. Pete Seeger would sing a song in his voice, and he'd go up and down and talk about all this. And he got to the point of teaching you how to, with a 5-string, to go bum, titty, bum, titty. You know, and Phil is over there trying to learn this bum, titty, and he would, like, miss the key on the titty, you know, the string, and then he'd pick it up and he'd start it over again. And I noticed I'm rocking faster in this rocking chair. You know, I'm starting to really rock fast. You know, the cat's tail's flicking. You know, the dog has got some froth on its mouth, you know, and they're all looking at me like, do something, you know, and I did. I got up and I got in the car. You know, the snow is starting to get really heavy, but I went into Connersville, which was a general store. That was the town. And I got 2 cheap gallons of wine, and I came home and I pulled that wine out of those bags and put them on the table. You know, and he looked at me and I looked at him, because he had seen me drunk in those taverns, and he didn't like me that way. And he went to bed. And I'll tell you, after 2 glasses of that, the dog was smiling, the cat was happy, and I felt better, you know. And Pete Seeger went flicking across the room, the Rolling Stones went on, and I cheered that snowplow through about 2 in the morning, you know. And he woke up about then, and he came and he stood at the door and he looked at me. And he gave me that look that I had seen in other people's eyes, specifically my parents and people that tried to help me and my sisters, and even my brother's eyes, people I had disappointed, people that didn't understand what was going on. He gave me that look of disappointment. Why can't you just smoke these things? Why do you have to act like that? You know? And when my head made a decision that night that I stuck to, when I make a decision, I don't let them tell us we don't have willpower. You know? Once we get to the point of making a decision, we have incredible willpower. And what I decided was, alcohol is more fun than you. Alcohol is more fun than you. And I made that decision that night, and that was in November, and it took me until the following summer to keep it, but I kept it. And finally, I drove him away, and I got blackballed by the organic circuit anyway, because I wasn't going to do primal therapy with him. What I wanted to do was get drunk and scream at the sheep, and that was fine for me. And they didn't want me around, so they blackballed me, and they went off to their primal therapy, and I was alone, and I was happy. I was really happy I was alone. I had one friend, Clarence the Farmer. I always wonder what happened to Clarence. He would bring the booze, and he would come visit me on his tractor, and the reason he would come on his tractor is because his license had been revoked for drunk driving. So he would come on his tractor, and he would bring the booze, and he wouldn't put in his teeth some nights, but that was okay, and but we would play my piano and sing Indian love songs, and the dog would howl, and we would get smashed, and that was a nightly thing. And then during the day, I would go out and tend my pot garden, because I had a half acre of marijuana that we were growing that he left me with when he left. And that's what I did that summer, was get drunk and weed my pot and eat my pot and live there all day long. And then I realized that winter was coming in northern Wisconsin. I decided I was never going to be cold again, and so I thought I had to harvest it. I had to harvest the pot. I had to sell it, and I had to get out of town before the snow started to fall, because it's cold up there. And so I made this decision, and for 3 days by horseback, I harvested this pot, and I did it the right way with the boiling water. I had pulled it by the roots. I took it to the house. I put the roots in the boiling water. The wood stove was going, and, you know, it shoves the resin to the top, and you run out to the machine shed, and you hang it upside down, you know. And I'm drinking and eating this pot obsessively for 3 days. That's all I'm doing for 3 days, and I'm living there. And by the end of 3 days, I had it all in hefty bags ready to go. I had found a contact. I had made this contact. I had decided that I was going to sell it all to this one guy and get out of town. So I drove 45 miles into Menominee, which was the big college town up there. And we get to the door, and you knock on the door, and you meet the people, and you figure out nobody's a narc. And, you know, and they looked at me, and they said, okay, well, where's the stuff? You know, and I looked at my dog. My dog looked at me. We forgot it. We left it back on the farm. So this is the way my life turns. So I make another decision. You know, I am real good. When they say maybe your best thinking got you here, think about it a while. What happened was, since I forgot the pot and I was embarrassed, I saw a carnival in town, and I thought, I always wanted to be a gypsy, so I got a job. And I got a job and decided I wanted to be a carnival worker, and that's what I did, and that's the way I got out of town. I loaded my pot in my car with my dog and a few things and left everything in this house and ended up becoming a shooting gallery girl with this carnival. And the cowboy boots came back on, and the rowdy bars were back in my, you know, back in my life, and I was happy. I was really happy because you blow into town for 2 or 3 days and just leave your mess behind you, so I thought. So I thought. And, you know, I didn't realize that I am an accumulation of what I do, you know. I have had a chance in Alcoholics Anonymous to wipe the slate clean. I have had a chance to make amends and start again. All of us have that chance with the 12 steps. It's amazing. Very few people get that in their lives. We get a chance to start all over again. But my decision that night was what I thought was the best thing for me. And now when I called home, my mother cries because she can't believe her daughter had done this. And so I can't call home anymore. You know, my mother cries, my father won't talk to me. I just stopped calling home. And I met him, and if that's where you want to meet him, that's where they are, girls. They're with the carnival. It's so otherworldly. I've been to carnival since then, and I kind of watch these people, you know. And to me, I was a totally different person then. You know, I have had a 180-degree turn in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have had a spiritual awakening as a result of working these steps. And that is not me anymore, but it was such a part of my life. And I got busted for drugs in Bogalusa, Louisiana, thrown in jail for 31 days. Nobody could get me out. My father flew down. My brother-in-law is an attorney. He tried to get me out. Nobody could get me out. They got me for sale. They got me for possession. They got me for all kinds of stuff. So I sat in this maximum security jail in Bogalusa, Louisiana for 31 days, and I wouldn't eat their grits, so they sent me to the dentist because my gums were receding and bleeding. And when I went to the dentist, they sent me in handcuffs and leg shackles. You know, and all the little boys there in the dentist's office, I remember them moving away from me. You know, and I remember thinking, they got the wrong person here. You know, I'm just out for a little recreational fun, you know. They didn't see it that way. It was hard time ahead of me. And they cut me loose and they said, go to work, you're going to pay a fine, you might do hard time, don't leave the state. And I found the French Quarter of New Orleans. And if anybody's been down there, it's a great place for an alcoholic. It's terrific. You can fall in one doorway, fall out of another doorway. I became a dancer because that's what I thought I liked to do. But if you make friends with the bartender and you drink too much Cavassier, you dance off the Baby Grand, you know? I would get stuck on the props all the time with my fishnet stockings. And I would wear platinum blonde wigs and short skirts, and I had a pet skunk and I had a pet snake, and I was really starting to get weird. I went off the piano too many times. I became a bartender because I did that better. And I started working at a local joint, and I found out what life was all about behind the bar. And I like to work local joints. See, I got a real nice job at one of the nice hotels down in the French Quarter, and I got fired for being drunk on the job because I always drank when I worked, you know. And the manager that was covering for me got fired, and the next day I got fired. And I had to sign one of those slips that said that I was fired, and I said, but I quit. And they said, but you're fired, you know. To get my check, I had to sign it. And I became blackballed from working at any of the nice places down there. And I didn't care anyway. I'd rather work the local joints where the bartenders come into my place, and I take good care of you, and you got a tab at my bar, because when I get off, I'm going to go to your place. And I got a tab, and you'll take good care of me. I would have 2 days off. I usually have 5 days on and 2 days off. I would spend my 2 days off at the Bastille. I mean, both days, right there in this one bar with Billy the bartender, my favorite guy. And they would take care of me. I could pass out and come to, and pass out and come to, and they'd put my purse under the bar, and they would take care of me. And I remember coming to once there, and on either side of me were the Chosen Few. There was this big biker gang, and they're called the Chosen Few, and we were drinking green chartreuse out of rock glasses. We were, like, slamming them down. And I was in this chug-a-lug contest when I came to with these big guys on both sides of me, and, you know, everybody's, like, cheering for us to put this green chartreuse, which is incredibly syrupy stuff with a high alcohol content. And I remember I couldn't quite get the last hits, but I was going to be darned, you know, the determination of the alcoholic, and I threw up in the glass, but I drank it back down, you know. And then I excused myself and went to the bathroom and got sick. But, I mean, that's the kind of alcoholic I was becoming. I mean, just repulsive. I started to gain weight, you know, no matter how much diet pills or uppers or crystal methadrine or whatever I took to try to keep me going. You know, I had pockets. I was lumpy when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My system had just stopped digesting, you know. I became Mama Cher. That's what they called me. I became more and more unemployable. My father and my mother came to visit me once. in the French Quarter, and they were in Texas moving somebody, and they came over to find me because they hadn't heard from me in a while, and they didn't know quite where I was, and they wanted to see me. And they found me living above the Mousetrap Bar, which was a biker bar, and it was a tar paper roof, and there were three apartments. There were three doors, screen doors. And on the first one, the guy that worked downstairs would drive his bike up the steps and into his apartment, you know, which is a one room. It's just this one room. And everything vibrated through this, like, the walls. And then the second one was Angela, who worked evenings, let's just say. You know, that's where she worked. And the third one was me and my boyfriend from the carnival, because we were still together. After 2 years of black eyes and knife fights, we were still together. And, you know, he had a heroin habit, and he'd get me first, and he was bigger than me, and then when he passed out, I'd get him, you know. And it was just some sort of a very sick existence, but people would say, you know, you deserve better than that, some of my friends, you know. And yeah, I knew that, but I didn't really, because he validated my existence. That's the only thing I had validating my existence was that sick relationship. But that's how my parents found me, living there with this guy, that kind of life. And my father couldn't look at me, and my mother had tears in her eyes. And when they left that day to go back to Iowa, I know that they wanted to say, it was on their lips, come with us, Sharon, you know. And I wanted to say, let me go with you, Mom, you know. But I knew nothing would change. I knew nothing would change. And I died a little bit more that day. There was a big piece of me that died that day. And I'll tell you, Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to make amends to those parents, to be of service to them. And I never thought that was possible because I had given up being a daughter. I had just given it up. And after Kirby's parole got pulled and he went to St. Louis, and I followed him there because it wasn't my idea and nobody leaves me, you know, I found him a couple months later after I'd been living in that town and working in that town, and he got off his motorcycle and he came around and he broke the window where I was sitting and he pulled me out by the hair and spit in my face and said, if I ever see you again, I will kill you. And that's when I knew the relationship was over, you know. I mean, I hang on like that, you know, with the screws down, my face in the sidewalk. I'm going to just look up at you with every bit of hate. I am not the type to surrender. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they said, you got to give up. I said, no, I don't, you know. But I was beaten enough that I thought, okay, I will. But I ended up working at a place that where you the guys come in off the boats, and they're not the guys that wear the uniforms and that are spit-shined, you know. They're the guys that work underneath the boats. They usually don't speak English. And they would come into this bar on Lower Decatur Street where I was working, and I was fat, and I stunk, and I didn't care about myself anymore. And they would put a quarter in the jukebox. They would buy me a drink, which was always Jose Cuervo Gold because that's what I drank. And they would buy themselves a drink, and then we'd have a dance, and they'd give me a dollar for that dance. And it wasn't a very crowded place. It's not like they were waiting in line to dance with me. But, you know, for that dollar dance, they got to do what they wanted with me. And I got fired for having a bad attitude. And when I begged for that job back, they didn't want me back. I had become unemployable, even on Lower Decatur Street, and that's pretty hard to do. I ended up coming out to Southern California a lot, and I didn't know why. I hated it. I mean, I knew that it was tilted, and all the fruits and nuts rolled right out there. And I didn't know, I couldn't stand it, you know. But I remember writing some letters back to some of my friends saying, God, you should see the cars and the people, and it's great. And just totally, and not even in any sense of reality, that I was dying. And I rolled into a place called Barney's Beanery, which is where Casey used to drink, too. And there's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, some of the sickest ones I know used to drink at Barney's Beanery. And we're very lucky to be out of it, out of that environment. But that was the first time I ever saw the Big Book was in that bar. And I remember them making a big deal about it because Chris was too drunk to drive, you know. So they called her a taxi to go to her A&A meeting with her Big Book under her arm and another friend. And they were both smashed, you know. And we cheered them out the door. And, you know, that's all I remember of this A&A stuff. And I saw that Big Book and out the door they went. And little did I know Chris was going to be my Eskimo years later. Well, months later, actually, because it was all the same as 1975. I went back to New Orleans. I had, I couldn't get a job. I couldn't speak. I remember I got off a plane and I couldn't talk. My mouth wouldn't work. I had to have enough to drink to even speak now. I had to maintain that level of alcohol inside of me to function at all. And then I would go over the edge and pass out and black out, and 2 days later come to with people I didn't know doing whatever, you know. I was having that kind of existence and I didn't care anymore. I didn't care anymore. And I met somebody going to Hawaii, and I said, sure, let's go. And I ended up in Barney's Beanery again, and he went somewhere and left me there. And that night that I was there, which was July 27th, 1975, there were a couple guys in front of the bar on their bikes, and they called Mama Cher out. You know, they called me out to go with them to Palm Springs. And I thought, oh, boy, I'm getting asked somewhere. I hadn't been asked somewhere in a while. And I found out later the reason they asked me was because they needed some weight on the back tire to go through the desert because it was windy. So they called the fat one out of the bar to come sit on the back tire. And when we got to, I was the lower companion. I had become the lower companion. When they got to where they were going in Palm Springs, they left me. And they left me in a nightclub somewhere, and I don't remember much about it, but I ended up with a couple of other guys, and these guys took me somewhere, and they beat me up. And they raped me, and they broke my jaw in three places, and they broke my nose. And they drugged me around in the cement so that when later on, during the course of the evening, I guess they had so badly bruised me that when the police finally found me, they did not think I was a Caucasian. I had so many bruises over my body. And these guys, that morning, took me outside of town and rolled me over a cliff and left me there. You know, and it was July, it was Palm Springs, it was the desert, it was hot. I was bleeding profusely from my mouth, and I was laying face down in the sand with no clothes on when I came to. And I came to, I don't know why I didn't pass out and stay passed out. But when I came to, I heard a voice. And what the voice said, the voice, not me. I'm incapable of being honest with myself, nor do I care about it. Nor do I even care about anything. The voice said to me, I want to live. Get up. I want to live. I thought, okay, I got up. It was like taking my first direction. And I crawled up the side, and I found a blacktop road, and I guess I found somebody's condominium. I passed out a foot away from the pool in a lawn chair. Or you'd have another speaker tonight. You know, it's seconds and inches that we're here. Norm used to talk about that. Seconds and inches that we get to sit here tonight, today. Seconds and inches that we get to sit here and judge the coffee, judge the speaker, judge each other, you know. But it's really, you think of the times that you drove home like this. You don't remember driving home, that you passed out an inch from the coffee table, you know, that you ended up in situations where you don't know how you got home safely. Seconds and inches. We're lucky people to have the choice to sit here. We have a choice to sit here today. A lot of people don't get it. And I became what I always wanted to become that day. You know, it was right there on the police piece of paper, docket, I don't know what they call it. It said victim, and my name was after that. Victim. I had been shooting for that one for a long time to show them what they did to me. Whoever they were, all those reasons, all those justifications that I had every time I sat down and ordered up Jose Cuervo Gold. I had justifications for the way it was coming down my life. And going into surgery that day, that voice happened again. I didn't want to hear this voice. This voice was being truthful. This voice was telling me the truth. You know, this voice said, you know what, it's not your dad's fault you're lying here on this gurney. You know, it's not these guys. These guys, the days my mother laid in bed not knowing what was wrong with me and where I was or how bad I was. And when the phone rings at night now, my mother doesn't have to flinch. I'm glad I can be a daughter she can trust and call, and I can confide in and ask her how to cook a turkey, because the only way I ever cooked a turkey was with marijuana stuffing before I got sober. You know? But I didn't know that, you know, on August 20th, I would be living above a liquor store. I didn't know that I would have nobody bailing me out. Thank you. I didn't know that I was going to make a call that day that was going to change my life, because I had to stick around to go to court because they caught these guys. I had to stick around to go back to these doctors. I was in pretty bad shape physically, and I was sipping on red wine through the wires where the tooth had been. There was a hole here, and I was sipping on red wine. I was on a liquid diet, you know. And alcohol wasn't doing it for me anymore. It was not doing it for me anymore. It was just like drinking Kool-Aid, but I didn't know what else to do. And he told me I had to leave. This guy I was staying with that felt sorry for me. And I was being pitied, and he felt sorry for me, but I had nowhere to go. I had absolutely nowhere to go, and I called my mother that day. And my mother told me words that changed my life, because she said, you know what, Sharon, I can't help you. Maybe you should go to the Salvation Army. And my mother's never been to Al-Anon. But she said those words that were like, it was like a horse kicked me in the stomach. And I made the next call because the number was there, and it was that girl Chris I had met in the bar, in Barney's Beanery, and she had been nice to me, and she gave me her number. And I called her that day because I needed somewhere to go. That's all. I had nowhere else. This guy was asking me to leave, and I was on the streets with my wired jaw, my sick person, and What happened was Chris said she couldn't help me, and this other woman could because Chris wasn't sober at the time, you know. And Suzanne was a woman named Suzanne. I called her, and I didn't know I was calling a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but, you know, they kind of take over, you know. It's just when, you know, I was a real rummy newcomer, and she sent two girls to get me, and I sat on the steps of that liquor store waiting for them to come, and these two perky girls, one blonde, one brunette, big-eyed, pretty, California tans, popped out of this Volkswagen and started coming at me, and I hated them immediately. I just, you know, what do they want? I sat around here for a long time waiting for the other shoe to drop. What do they want from me? You know, I kept waiting for that shoe to drop. Keep coming back. Yeah, right. Okay. What do you want from me? And, but my jaw was wired shut. For the first 3 months I was here, I said nothing. You know, I just thought these things. And a beautiful thing happened. After a while, after I got a little more sober, I learned to listen. I started to listen because I wasn't running my mouth. And I became teachable. But that wasn't right away. I mean, this first meeting was a meeting of the Pacific Group, which is a group in Southern California that's very active. And if you walk into one of those meetings, they stick their hands out. They give you phone numbers. I mean, it's like, you just better stand there and you keep your right hand free all the time, you know. And they put me in the front row, and I don't know how they all knew I was new, but they did, you know. And I, that, you know, you could smell me coming. And they gave me a big book, and I gave them my last quarter. I had a quarter in my jeans pocket, and I remember I gave them my last quarter because you're not going to give me anything, you know. And I passed the 20 questions and made this man really happy. And, you know, 17, I said no to a few. I do have my pride. I didn't quite think I was a lower companion. You know, I didn't quite think I was there. But I remember saying no to that one. But this man, I made his night. I mean, he lit up like a Christmas tree. I didn't understand it. And I don't remember anything they said. I remember them bringing out the big book and beating on it. And I thought, where's the holy water? Where's the forever stuff? Where is it? You know, when do they ask me to commit myself to whatever? When do they ask me to sign over my worldly possessions? When do I take the IQ test? When do they ask me about my potential and how I screwed up my life? Where does it start here, you know? And they didn't do that. They just said, oh, keep coming back. Don't drink and use between meetings, and we'll pick you up tomorrow night. And I had no choice. You know, they dropped me off at the liquor store, and they would sit and talk to me because their sponsors had told them that you wait until those liquor store lights go off, and then you send her upstairs. And that's love. That's love for an alcoholic, you know. They sat there with this mopey, drooly, stinky person and loved me by waiting for those liquor store lights to shut off. And then they sent me upstairs. And then they moved me out of there. And I, too, was asleep. I slept on people's couches. I was moved around. I was passed around and given a sleeping bag. And I would sleep on someone's floor for a week. And then at the end of that week, I would get rejected, you know. And they would move me on to somebody else. And I kept getting rejected all the time. And I was so sensitive. But I didn't say anything, you know. I just kept coming back. I had nowhere else to go. I had to go down to Palm Springs for court. I had to go down to the doctors. I met people down there in Alcoholics Anonymous that were wonderful, kind, loving people that took care of me when I had to go through this stuff. And I didn't even have to ask them. They were just there. And I started to feel a little bit like maybe I had taken a few steps away from what walked in the doors on August 20th, 1975, at about 3 months of sobriety. You know, because by then I had been pushed into getting a sponsor. You know how they are. They don't leave you alone until you get a sponsor. Anyway, that's the way they do it in my group. And this guy with a tattooed tear and a Texas accent kept sticking his finger in my chest. And he kept telling me to get a sponsor. I'd get drunk. And I didn't like Michael, so I got a sponsor so I could tell him to back off. I mean, that was the only reason I got a sponsor. And I learned one thing. Motives don't count. My actions are what count. Because what happened as soon as I got a sponsor and asked her, she was overjoyed. She moved me up to her couch. I mean, that was a spiritual experience for me. I had been sleeping on floors on a borrowed sleeping bag. All of a sudden, I get a sponsor. My life changes because I get to sleep on a couch. I mean, it got immediately better. That was a spiritual experience for me. And I thought I put that somewhere. I connected it somewhere in my brain. And what happened was the sponsor started to make me pray, too. And I don't know about you, but I prayed to a bedspread for a long time. You know, and I would wait for her to go to sleep, and I'd wait for her to be in that deep sleep, and I would listen at her door before I ever hit my knees in her house, you know, because I felt so awkward and embarrassed about it. But I knew that that was part of the requirement of staying there, was to say this little one-line prayer on my knees at night, because then I knew she'd ask me the next day if I did it, you know. I just knew she would, you know. And finally, the wires came off. I had to go to work, and I started, they wouldn't let me be a bartender, so I became a food waitress. And I had a bad attitude about it. Now, if you're a food waitress in a breakfast place with a bad attitude, you make no money. Absolutely no money. And they asked me one night how things were going. And I said, crappy. And they said, well, how are the tips? You know, how's the place? It's a nice place. And I said, well, the tips are crappy. And they said, well, why don't you change your attitude and smile at him? I said, because I don't feel like it. Aren't we supposed to be honest and share our feelings? And, you know, that's what I was doing. I was moping around sharing my feelings with life, and I didn't realize, I mean, I was taught how to be a good employee here. They don't care how you feel. They want you to suit up and show up and do the work. I mean, I did not know that. I missed it. I was gone the day in school they talked about that, you know? And that's what they taught me here. They taught me how to put on an Al-Anon smile, and they brought Sally over, and they showed me how to do one of these, you know? And so that night I went out and tried it, and my tips got better, and they didn't know I was faking it. And I thought, boy, this is great, you know? And I learned a lesson, a valuable lesson. And I got a $24 a week room. I got a teddy bear. I got a telephone. I got my first obscene phone call and a cheap car, and I felt like I fit in. I mean, it was like life was happening. And I got a better job at a better restaurant, and I remember calling my sponsor one morning and telling her that I had the brain tumor and I couldn't go to work, and I was tired. I was going to stay at home and sleep. And she said, well, if you die at home in your bed, no AA funeral, but if you go to work and you die there, we'll give you this AA funeral. And she hung up the phone on me. You know, slammed the phone down on me. Well, she made me mad, you know? And when I get mad, I get motivated. You know, I let my anger work for me a long time around here. I had a clean house the first 10 years I was sober because I was so angry. You know, now I'm mellow. You come in my house, oh, Sharon's mellow. You can tell. But, you know, I let my anger work for me. And it got me there, and I did everything she wanted me to do because I wanted to call her at 5 o'clock and say, you were wrong, it doesn't work, I did everything you said. But by the time 5 o'clock rolled out, I was out of my head, I was out of myself, I was being more of service to the world, and I had a good day. I've never had to call a sponsor at the end of the day after I've asked them for direction or they've given me direction in the morning. I've done everything they've said. I've never had to call them and say, you were wrong. You know, I have always had a sponsor that has been louder than my own head. And that's real important for me because I listen to them. It doesn't matter why. I listen to them. And I got emotionally involved, and he had 6 more months than me, 27 and a half tattoos, and that was it. I fell in love. And, you know, I didn't know much about myself then, you know, and I was still into being a lot of a rebel. But we had a lot of fun together. He made the coffee. I did the cookies. We had an AA relationship. We had an AA wedding, and my mother and father and my two sisters came out for the wedding. And my dad walked me down the aisle. And my dad told me at the end of that day, he gave me some of his approval. He said, you know, Sharon, why don't you think about, next time you want to leave or go do something crazy, look at the people here. You've got it made. And I thought, you know what, Dad, you're right. It wasn't like the sky opened up and the angels sang and the earth shook because my father finally gave me approval. It was like I knew it because I already had my own approval. I had already worked enough of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to get some self-esteem, to get some worth of myself. And working the fourth step was real, real hard for me, real hard for me. I was 11 months sober, and I didn't want to do it. And I was beginning to hear at meetings about my slip. Oh, I'm so glad I had my slip. And if I wouldn't have had my slip, I wouldn't have learned this. And I started to listen, you know. My thinking was starting to get funny. And I started calling my sponsor less. And all of a sudden, I got this credit card in the mail. And I thought, it's God's will. It's time to have my slip, you know. I'm 11 months sober, and if I stick around here for a year, I'm committed forever. So let's go do it now. And I ended up at the airport, and I thought, well, let me just call Janet and just say goodbye, and I'll be back. You know, don't worry about me. I'll be back. And she was a little ticked off because I hadn't been in touch with her, and I told her that I was at the airport and I was going to go have my slip and that I would be back. And she said, you know, she didn't yell at me. She just told me this story that I think they go to sponsor school and learn, you know, these stories. Because what she told me was, she said, my friend Stella did that. She wouldn't write her inventory either. And she went out and had her slip, and she burned up in a bed. You know, and I held the phone like, where'd this come from? You know, but then I started thinking about Stella and burning up in a bed. Then I started thinking about me burning up in a bed, and she made me mad again. You know, and I went and I bought a pencil and I bought a notebook and I started to write my inventory right there at the airport. And I got past the fear. I got past the fear. I went on faith for just a moment, just to get past it. Faith to me is an action. You know, I can't sit around and have faith. I have to do faith. It's a verb for me. And I got past it that night. And I did my fifth step with her. And you know what? I write every inventory at the airport. Whenever I have one to write, I go sit there and write it. It just works for me. I don't know what it is. So if you find a place that works for you, fine. And I took my first year birthday cake, and I felt like I deserved it. And it was the hardest thing I had to do, was sharing that with her. and writing that inventory. 4 and 5 were real tough for me because it made a commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. It made me feel more like I earned my seat here. And it made me feel good about myself because it was the first time I had walked through that much fear without picking up a drink. And she yelled at me one night. This was after we had, you know, been through the fifth step, and she was still my sponsor until I was about 4 years sober. And I think I was a couple years sober that night. And I, you know, you get your rights back or something after you do your inventory and you're 1 year sober, and you kind of get your rights back. And I was in that stage of getting my rights back. And I was talking to some new people, and I was maybe being a little bit egotistical or something. And she came up to me and got in my face, which she did a lot. You know, she was shorter and littler than me, but she always intimidated me. And she got right up in my face. She said, "You better find a God or you're going to get drunk." And right then and there, Beacon's Moving Van drove by. And I said, "Okay, Janet, you know what? I'm going to pick Beacon's Moving Van. That's my higher power. You said I could pick anything? I'm going to pick Beacon's Moving Van." And she said, "Good, it's not you." You know? And it made sense to me at the time. And then the other newcomers gathered around. We talked about how I'd been from place to place to place all over the country and how it's like being in a moving van. And God kind of kept me in the back and, you know, wrapped me in those quilted things. And maybe I was a little bruised and there was a little bit of nick in the furniture. But, you know, we got to Alcoholics Anonymous in one piece. And they're all going, yeah. And, you know, my sponsor and the other old-timers are just shaking their head like, "You are sick," you know. But even today, as Julie and Casey and I were sitting in a little restaurant having lunch, around the corner drove Beacon's Moving Van. And I went, it just lit up the moment, you know. It still makes me feel better wherever I am. And I see a Beacon's truck, it's like, oh, thank you, I'm not in charge. You know, it just feels so good. It makes me feel good. I mean, that's where it started for me, a connection with a God of my own understanding. Believe me, my own understanding. And my life has become, I don't want to say more spiritual, but it has, because I've walked through a lot of tough stuff to really have that faith inside, to have those instincts that work. I've worked on 6 and 7. I had to come to terms with my anger many, many times over the course of my sobriety. I've had to come to terms with jealousy. You know, that's a big one for me. At 5 years of sobriety, I had trouble in my marriage, and we hung in there. And I got pregnant, and I didn't know I could do that. And on June 23rd, 1984, my son was born. And I didn't know I could do that. I didn't know I wanted to do that. He had all his fingers and all his toes. And I knew a God that day. At 10 years of sobriety, my husband walked out. And I told you how people leave me, you know, not very easily. You know, I kind of follow you around until I decide maybe it's time for me to leave you. But you've already left years before, you know. That's just kind of the way I am. And what happened was, when he walked out the door, and I'm on a phone with a newcomer telling him to like themselves and giving them direction to things that will build their self-worth, I can't go hang on his leg and be the doormat. I mean, it just didn't work. I had to let him go. And I went through a lot of pain in that year, because nobody got custody of the meetings. You know, he kept going to the same meetings. I kept going to the same meetings. And, you know, what happened was, there was another woman involved, and she was newer than me, and she was younger than me, and I didn't think she was as pretty as me, and you know, but he chose to be with her, and I'd circle my wagons, and he'd circle his wagons, and she was on this other softball team, and I had played softball for a lot of years, and with Julie, and I re-upped again, because this softball team played her softball team, and she was a left-handed hitter, and I played second base. And we were at the Oxnard tournament, and I'll never forget it, because it was one inning that she was hitting the ball. She was up 3 times, and she hit the ball in the dirt, and I laid in front of it, you know. She hit the ball another time, and I was caught a line drive. She hit another one, and I laid my face in front of it, you know. And by the end of that inning, her team stood up and gave me a standing ovation. It was just like, I was determined, you know. But that's part of how I worked through that year. And one Saturday night meeting, I was standing on one corner of the room, and it's a very crowded meeting. It's probably got about 3 times the number of people in here, and there's a lot going on. It's Saturday night, and everybody's feeling good, and I hated Saturday nights as I was going through this painful divorce, because everybody seemed to have somebody. You know, that's when I would go and drive my car 100 miles an hour and hope that they'd stop me, because then I was going to just right into the center divider, you know, be real dramatic about it, and they were never there when I was going 100 miles an hour. They just weren't. You know, I was doing insane things like shoplifting and hoping to get caught at 10 years of sobriety. I was doing things like that and not talking to anybody about it. And I was being really, really just into my victim role. I had the blackout and, you know, the little hanky up here, you know, and I was looking at how I had been wronged and betrayed Boy, that word was a big one for me, betrayal. And I was at that Saturday night meeting, and I just had enough of their happiness, you know, because they were over laughing at the other side of the room. So I went and got two cups of black coffee, and I thought I was going to go over and see how spiritual they were and throw the coffee on them. And my sponsor, who was then at the time a guy named Clancy, he's my sponsor today, he just happened to be at that meeting that night, and he's always out of town a lot, but he happened to be there. And it was like the room stood still. You know, he saw me on one end, he saw where my eyes were headed on the other end, he saw the two cups of coffee in my hand, and he kind of made his way to the middle, and he stopped me. He got me. He got right in my face. He took the coffee and put it down on the table. He grabbed me by the shoulders, and he looked at me and said, "Sharon, you will walk through this with dignity and grace so you can be an example for others." You know, it's like, I heard him. It's this example stuff gets to me, you know, this being an example gets to me, you know, because I feel real special to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and to carry the torch, you know, because it's carried ahead of me. And if people weren't lighting the way for me, where would I be? You know, and they're out there making their mistakes and staying sober. And I need that ahead of me. And so he told me I had to do that for the person behind me. And I let go of it that night. You know, I had a sponsor named Jenny for a number of years, and she was wonderful. She told me a little bit about myself and a little story. She said, "You are like a person with a gift in your hand. And it's like a precious stone. And you clutch it and you hold it in your fist all the time. And you put it in your pocket and we never get to see what you're holding and what you're protecting and what you've got there. And one day you trusted me enough to let me peel back your fingers and look in your hand to see what you were guarding and protecting with your life. And I looked in your hand and what I saw was a turd." And I looked at her and I said, "I know, Jenny, but it's my turd." And that's the way I let go of things, you know. But I heard Clancy that night. And I wrote another inventory and I told him about all the things I had been doing. I gave up the keys to Al's car because I was going to drive it in the ocean. I had an extra set of keys. And I was ready to do that. And the ironic twist of all of this is about 2 months ago, he's been married to her and they have a baby. And we all got comfortable with all of that. Because of my son and everything. I mean, we were standing in the backyard one 4th of July. We wear name tags. And there was Al B. and Jill B. and baby Daryl B. and my son's name, Wesley B. and Sharon B. And we're all conversing and pictures being taken. And it's like, oh, my God, I never thought this would happen. I'm comfortable with this situation. And about 2 months ago, he left her. And the ironic twist is that I am the example of walking through it with dignity and grace for her. And It's incredible, Alcoholics Anonymous. You never know why things happen. Sometimes you never find out, you know. But in retrospect, you know, looking back on it, if I would have made that other turn, I know I would be drunk and dead. And I know that I have to be an example for whoever needs me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, whenever the hand is out there, I got to be there with mine. And I know that. It's one drunk talking to another. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. And I have been there for her the past month. And we talk. She doesn't open up quite so deeply with me, but she knows I'm there for her. And we have decided and made a pact that our sons will grow up knowing each other because they're stepbrothers, and they should, and they will. And my life today is incredibly different than it was at 5 years of sobriety or 10 years of sobriety. I just turned 15 in August, and I have a terrific job today. I work for a law firm. I paid my attorney so much money for this divorce where we fought over record albums, I decided that's where the money is, so that's where I started to go to work. I have a respected position with them. I work with the managing partner, and they listen to my opinion. They don't know who they have working there. They have no idea that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that I used to do wild and crazy things, and now that I'm of service to Alcoholics Anonymous, they have no idea. What they see is a good employee. What they see is a citizen. I even vote today. I was told if I wanted to complain, I have to vote, you know, and so that's what I do. And I feel good about my life. I suit up and I show up. I have my son is in a Catholic school, and that was kind of a weird twist of events. I put him in a private school at kindergarten, and the Lutherans and him didn't cut it at all, and he got asked to leave in December. He was not even a semester through, and he was becoming the bad kid, and we had a lot of problems, my son and I. And I made a commitment to him, and he is a sensitive, right-brained kid. He's the type of child that can express himself. And he needs to do that. And I moved him to this other school, and I thought I had become a failure. I thought I did something wrong. And then I remembered the story that Ken Devaney tells about the plant. And sometimes you just have to move the plant, because his wife had given this plant when his wife left. He left it in the corner to die. He didn't water it, didn't give it sunshine, nothing. And he thought it was just about gone, dead, you know. And he moved it out on his balcony. And then one day his neighbor called him and said, hey, your plant's growing up into my plants. You know, and when I went through this problem, I called Ken and I asked him about this story, and he said, sometimes you just have to change the environment. And I felt okay about it. I started to be, instead of being the victim, I had a choice. I became a mother. And my son is flourishing. He is flourishing. He is comfortable. He is secure. And he's the type of child that, we were watching E.T. one day, and I went to do some dishes because we watch video. I don't know if you're a parent, you watch the same video 80 times, you know. And here we are in this party where E.T. dies, and I always cry, so I went to do dishes anyway. And you know, he put the Nerner, the, what's it called, the remote control, on, we call it the Nerner, on pause. And I hear these little feet coming out, and he's got tears streaming down his face. And for the 80th time, he's crying while E.T.'s dying. And you know, he said to come sit with him a while, so I did that, and I came and I sat with him for a while. And then, you know, E.T. comes back to life, and things are fine, so I went back to finish the dishes, and I hear the paws go on, the little feet come out again, and he's got more tears in his eyes. And I said, what's wrong, honey? E.T.'s alive. And he said, but sometimes, Mom, don't you cry when you're happy? Instead of saying, oh, yeah, forget it, you know, I got down on his level, and I talked to him about feelings. And it was a really special moment because nobody did that with me. You know, they didn't maybe know how, they didn't have time, but I am able to communicate with my son. I'm able to get down on his level and be his pal. And I'm really busy, and it's hard sometimes, but I try to give him that respect. And it's made a major difference in his life because I always wanted to change the world. I was out there in the peace marches. I'd hitchhike just to get my moratorium button all the way to Washington, D.C., you know. I was out there trying to change the world, and I didn't know what I wanted to change it to. But I have a chance to raise a healthy child and break that legacy. I have a chance to make the world a little bit better by raising a child that is secure within himself, that wants to be of service to the world. And he's God's kid. And I know that, and I've been given that gift to be a mother, and it's a real important part of my life. I am. My parents, my father and I have been around and around and around. And used to sound like that. About 7 years sober, my sponsor, Jenny, asked me if I owed him any money. And I had made the written amends to my dad, and I thought, well, yeah, I guess I do. How do they know about this stuff, you know? And the sponsor school again. So I called him and I asked him if I could pay him back and make amends to him. And he said, sure. And he gave me this figure, you know, like he had been sitting there waiting for me to call for a couple of years. And he had the big book, so he might have, you know, I don't know. My dad's a Capricorn. So he gave me this figure and I called her back and I said, you know, Jenny, you gave me this figure. I think it's a little high. She says, I don't care. What can you afford? And we talked about it. She said, in a couple of days, call him back and tell him that you're going to pay him so much money a month. And I thought, good, in a couple of days he'll remember, I never went to Europe like everybody else. I never got a car like everybody else. I took a lot of cars, but none was never given to me. I charged up a lot of credit cards that were his, but I never went to Europe, you know. And I thought, well, he'd remember that, and I paid for my own wedding, you know. That maybe he'd remember that. But no, he said, fine. And I called her back, and I said, he said, fine. And she said, okay, well, that's good. Then make out your envelopes on the first of every month without fail, because you're an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's that word again. You send him off the check. And she said, and by the way, put a note about your life and what you're doing. Just a personal note with every check. And I thought, make me grow. I mean, push me to the wall. That's what they do, you know. So I said, okay. I don't do things willingly, but I do things. And I put a note and a check in the mail to my father every month for over 3 years. And he called me one holiday season, and he said, Merry Christmas, Sharon. You don't have to send me any more checks, but don't stop sending me your notes. And it was like the guilt was relieved. The baggage was cut loose. I can now be a daughter with my father. I can be a friend with my father. I don't have to look at him and feel guilty. I went home a year ago, and I was in Iowa for a convention. And a bad girl comes home to do good, you know, and it felt really good to go home and to be of service. And I was sitting around a table, and my mother was cooking, and it was just my father, my son, and me. And something happened that night as I heard the locusts singing and the sun was setting, and there was some peace in the air. I felt like I was a part of that family for the first time in my life, and I never thought that would happen, ever. And it was another gift of sobriety, another gift of this program. Alcoholics Anonymous is my life today, because if I keep it first, everything else falls into place. I have a great relationship with Casey. We operate on a level that is spiritual and a lot of fun, and he's got a crazy sick past like me, and we get along great, you know. It's we went today down to the North Beach District where he used to live years ago and took a picture of him under Big Al's, you know, and I knew I liked that man even more then, you know, and because of where he comes from and the difference that his life has, the different life he has today with the chance in Alcoholics Anonymous to have what we have. And we are sick people who come together to get well. We are not bad people who come together to get good. It is not a moral issue, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is not anybody's fault that I am an alcoholic. I drank alcohol, it worked for me, and I am here. And I have come to terms with many things in my life, and I have made new choices because I have done new living. Not always willingly, but it has happened for me that way. I have had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. I have freedom today in my life, you know? That was Janis Joplin used to sing, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose, you know? And look where she is. And that's where I was going, you know? And I found that freedom was the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's by sharing my story, my experience, strength, and hope with you on a one-to-one level. It's by being a child of God and having a second chance and being grateful for it on a daily basis. Thank you so much for having me. I love you.